Hi, folks. My name is Al White, and I'm an alcoholic. It's a rather large group you got up here. That's great. The last time I spoke in front of a group like this was in Folsom, I think. When I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to do a little chatting up here, I like to get a couple of things kind of straight before I get started. One is that sometimes I give my opinions about things. And the reason I give my opinions about things is because before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any opinions. I only had the facts. Now, opinions being what they are, they're subject to change. And my opinions change, sometimes rapidly. And sometimes I say something and someone gets kind of a resentment about it. Well, don't do that, because very often on the way home I change my mind about that. And you can lay awake all night with a resentment against somebody on your side, you see. As far as drinking alcohol, it started somewhere around, I was in the city of Philadelphia, born and raised in Kensington. All right, there we go. God bless you, sweetheart. I was born in Kensington, and I didn't fool around with alcohol. I didn't like the stuff. I had a taste of it here and there until I was about 18. The war was on, and I had a few drinks around 18, but I didn't like that stuff, you know. I just didn't like the taste of that stuff. And so as my friend Dennis and I were talking about on the driving over here, even though I didn't like it and I didn't drink it, you know, I just had a beer here or something like that. I went in the Navy in 1944, and by the end of 1945, when I came home, as soon as I got home, I got arrested for being drunk. So in that short period of time, something, you know, alcohol evidently was a bad thing for me. But I didn't mind it too much, you know. But I did notice something. I stayed in the Navy. I shipped over after the war. And I stayed in the Navy, and I noticed something happening to me. I started to get headaches. I started to get bad headaches. I don't know if any of you folks ever got those, but I got these bad headaches. Well, they were so bad. These headaches were so bad that you know how your veins pop out in your head and they throb and throb and throb. And I would be, you know, I'd be back here on the base or on the ship and trying to solve this headache thing. And I found something, that if I held my head in a certain position, I didn't have any pain, you know. And I thought that was a great discovery, but it was awful trying to go around, you know, trying to do your duty with this, and people coming up and banging you on the back, and you know, and then these headaches, you know, you find that place and you want to sneak off somewhere, you know, and then people would find you. And then a little while later, I started to get the heaves, and then it was very difficult trying to hold your head in a certain position while you heave, you know. So I was developing these things. Headaches and heaves, two headaches, it sounded like two H's there, whatever that means. But anyway, I had these headaches and heaves, but it wasn't an extraordinary price to pay for the fun I was having, you see. It wasn't all that bad. So I just kept on drinking, and things kept getting worse, and then after a while, I started having these here navigation problems. When I would get loaded, I wasn't one of those. I've seen people who could be stone drunk and walk a straight line, and I was a zigger and a zagger, I'll tell you. And so my life progressed. I had got the navigation problem, and then I started to forget. Forgetting sometimes is good. There's always people wanting to let you know what you forgot. But what would happen is sometimes I'd forget to get back on time. That was serious. And so things start to multiply. One thing led to another. you know, the headaches, the heaves, and now I'm having these blackouts. And I'm over in China, and I get lost. And we have a little thing. We had a big ship's party in Hong Kong. Wonderful party. Oh, you should have been there. It was wonderful. It really was. It was wonderful. We had the officers against the enlisted man. You know, in a football game in this big hotel at a ship's party. And I was a enlisted man. And the little me and these big officers, and we had fun. And then Liberty was up somewhere around dusk. And a couple of fellows and I had met these ladies and were going to show us the sights. And so they took us off to show us these sights, you know. I always wanted to see the sights. So we woke up in this, somewhere on Victoria Hill in a beautiful hotel. I swear, I don't know how three enlisted men got in a place like that. But it was nice, really nice. And I'm a destroyer setter now, you know. We see this. There was a T-urn, and it must have been 4 or 5 feet high. And it was probably chrome, but I saw it as silver, you know. And it's very expensive. And I said to one of the fellows, Rogers, I said, Rogers, can you see that thing in the First Division crew quarters? Wouldn't that look beautiful? Nobody in the fleet's got anything like that. Well, the idea was, how are you going to get something this big down through the lobby and out and down to the dock, right? So we had realized also that this was the next morning, and we should have been back at dusk. Well, what we did is we tied these sheets around this thing and we're lowering out the window, you know. And what do we hear but clop, 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 clop. And here comes the Chinese cavalry patrol. And this cavalry patrol, they pick us up and take us down to the dock and they leave that urn there. And they march us down in front of these doggone horses. And it was awful because here's these Navy officers. They had been looking for us all night. They thought the communists had got us and captured us and taken us away, you know, and we were just up seeing the sights is all we were doing. Well, by golly, things started to get worse. And then I shipped over again. I really liked the Navy. I liked it. But now, after about 7 years. Yeah, I was 7 years and I was still a seaman. I hadn't got anywhere yet. But on the other hand, that wasn't all that important either at the time. So I was starting to slip though, more with these forgetting, and a lot of things were happening. I was getting these captains' masks, and then they got to these deck court-martials, and time was marching on, and I realized that I'm going to have to get out of the Navy. I realized that. Because I had believed by now that I'm an alcoholic. I believed it. I started tearing up Liberty cards. I ripped up my Liberty card because I figured, if I don't have a Liberty card, I can't go ashore. If I can't go ashore, I can't drink. If I can't drink, I can't get drunk. If I can't get drunk, I can't get in trouble. And that's how I... But that wasn't an answer, because you can only stay on a ship so long, and then you need another Liberty card. You just have to get off. But anyway, there I was... And I knew I was going to have to get out. I had been getting in trouble and trouble and trouble. And this chief and I, he was a heavy drinker like me. And so we decided there was a test came out. I don't know if anybody ever saw that test. But there was a test came out. And this test said to find out if you are an alcoholic. And what you were to do was to drink 3 drinks of whatever it is you drank and then stop. If you drank every day beer, drink 3 drinks of beer every day and stop each time. If it's whiskey, drink 3 drinks of whiskey. So the chief and I, boy, I'm dry as heck up here. The chief and I decided that we're going to take this test. So we went ashore in Charleston, South Carolina, and we went into a bar, and the chief and I said, we're going to take this test and find out if we're alcoholics. Once and for all, we'll know. And so we sat down and we ordered a beer, and we drink the beer down, and then we drink another beer, and then we get the third beer and we drink it. And so we get up. Thank you very much. We get up. I should have thought to do that myself. I tell you, you think that's something. I tell you, my wife says I get lost in a phone booth. I can't remember where the hell I'm doing. I was laying on the couch tonight waiting for the 8 o'clock movie to come on when my wife told me, "You're supposed to go out tonight." I had forgotten all about it. And not only that, I tell you how, I went out here to get a drink of water at the break. And I saw these people line up, and I got behind this young lady. And then I noticed there's about 8 more ladies there. So you know what you got up here, don't you? You know, he don't know what's going on. That's why Dennis comes with me, to look out for my wife sends him. Anyway, so we go outside, and the chief looks at me and he says, "How do you feel?" I said, "Chief, I feel fine." He says, "I feel fine too. I guess we're not alcoholics. Let's go across the street and try that again." Well, you know what happened. Well, the last thing before I left the Navy, the last nail in the coffin, I was in trouble again. Jeez. And I don't know if any of you people used to lie. But I lied and lied and lied about things. And so when I was in trouble, and the executive officer took me into the wardroom, and he said, "White," they always call us by our last name, you know. He said, "White, what is it with you? Why is it that you're always going ashore and getting drunk? Why are you always in trouble?" And it struck me that this man is trying to help me. He wants to help me out of this situation. So it dawned on me that I better get a good one. So I hung my head a little, and I said, "Well, sir, I don't like to talk about it, you know. And of course, what, white, you know. And I said, "Well, sir, it's my brother and my mother. My brother's gone blind. And my mom's getting up there in years, and I always worry about it. And so I go ashore, and I think about people, you know, them back there in Philadelphia, and here I am down here in Carolina, and I can't get to them to help them. And you know what they did, don't you? They sent me home on emergency leave." And my brother can see better than I can right now, I think. But anyway, that was the last lie I had. That I could really use it. And so when I was 11 and a half years, I had to take my... I didn't ship over again. I went home. I went home to Philadelphia. And things really went down the tube. I mean, really went down the tube. Because I was running wild. But I was... Here's what was happening to me. See, first, you know, these headaches left. These headaches left. The heaves never left. 6 months after I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, about they left. And the blackout never left. And I was out there, I was a busy drunk, you know. I was busy. I had all these facts for people, you know. And I wanted to give information out. And lots of people don't want to hear it, you know. But I want to give them stuff out. I was one of them guys that, I love facts and figures. And I remember I was sitting in a bar one time and a guy sat down alongside of me. And he looked at me and he said, "Say, do you know that every time I open my mouth, somebody dies?" I had never thought about it. But this was startling news to pass on. And so armed with this new statistic, I left this bar immediately and headed for another bar to pass that along. And so I moved me right into a bar and I sat down alongside a guy and I got a drink. And I said to the guy next to me, I said, "Say, fella, do you know that every time I open my mouth, somebody dies?" And he said, "Well, why don't you shut your damn mouth?" Truth. Anyway, that's the way I was going, see? That's the way I was going. And then I was having I was starting to have a little trouble with, I don't know, with blood. You know, when these thieves. Probably because, you know, a lot of strain on this disease. So, it started to scare me. So I just started to drink stuff with tomato juice in it, and then when I threw up, I expected it to be red, and it didn't bother me anymore. And I solved that. And then I started to hear these voices, and they would say, "Hey, Al, yo, Al." Well, I turn around, and there's nobody there. Nobody there. Al. Nobody there. Well, that's unnerving to me. You know, I was unnerving. So what I did, I decided the way to handle this, I just wouldn't answer. And that's how I solved that problem. People could call me forever, and I wasn't going to turn around. I wasn't going to look around here. And then I was, you know, things, I was getting where I couldn't eat, and my drunks were getting further apart because it took so long to get well. My hangovers were horrible, horrible thing. And so, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was drinking less than I ever drank. But it took so long to get well enough to drink again. So, I was having these things, you know, like they would be talking to me. And I was living in New Jersey at the time, and I'd stay up all night long, and I wanted to scream, and I knew I was going mad. And I lay on the floor, and I dig my hands into the rug to keep them screaming, you know. And then a wonderful thing happened. A show came on called The World's Worst Movies. That was the title of it. And it showed cowboy movies all night long. Buck Jones and Tom Mix. And, you know, my old kid died. So these things started to come on, and I started to get involved in these shows. I was alone, so I could get involved. And so me and Buck had cut him off at the pass, and we'd round up the cattle. And you know, the inevitable waterfall that we go under, I'd say, "We're coming close to the waterfall, Buck," you know, to get digging. And, you know, it was, that's the way it was going with me. I was involved in these cowboy shows. But it was getting worse, and I started to drink close to the hospitals because I knew I was dying and I wanted to be near the doctors, you know. And then I started sleeping in hospital lobbies or getting there when I you know. And then the ultimate happened. You know, I was having a lot of heart problems. Boom, boom, you know how it goes. Boom! Yeah. And so I ran into this emergency ward. Oh man, I ran into the emergency ward, and they, what's wrong? I said, "My heart stopped." And the guy said, "Where did you come from?" And I told him someplace down there. He said, "That's a good trick, you know." So I was having, things were, you know, really getting bad, and I wanted to commit suicide. Now it was so bad, I just wanted to destroy myself, to kill myself. There was a problem with it. If I kill myself, I'd be dead. And that was a problem because if I'm dead, I'm going to hell. You see? So I just wanted to kill myself and not be dead. But then I tried to figure out how should I kill myself. You see? I don't like heights anymore. So, you know, I can't get up there to do the job. I didn't have a weapon of my own. I had a wooden pistol, but I did. And so I decided the Philadelphia subway would be it, because nobody survived the Philadelphia subway. And so I went to the Philadelphia subway to commit suicide, and then I thought about it. And I realized that just before I die, the wheel is going to be right here on the side of my... And it will hurt like hell. And not only that, but people are going to work, coming home from work, shopping, and you're going to disrupt everybody. And I was too considerate to do that. So I stayed away from subways, because I did not know when I would jump. I just stayed away from them. The only time I used a subway, I would have a token in my hand. I go down to the subway, I stand outside the turnstile, and when the subway stopped, I put it in a slot, run through the turnstile onto the train. I could not take a chance. And that's how it was. So I left home. The one thing left to do, run away. Get away from whatever it is that's doing it. So I had $28 and a bus ticket, and I came to California. And you know what happened. But I left home. I came out here, and I got out here, and I immediately got in trouble. I had a bird. I don't know if anybody... This damn bird would come diving at me. At the oddest times, he'd come, rawr, and just come across, rawr, at me, you know. And this damn bird, now sometimes on the subway he'd get me, you know, and, you know, you'd try, and nobody helps, you know. You know, all they do is there's a wackos at it, you know, wacko over there. Byberry, what do you mean Byberry? They don't realize, you know, you got a real problem here. So anyway, that's how it was when I came to California. And I picked right up, obviously. And I didn't know what to do. I was at my wit's end. And I was going insane. I was absolutely going insane. I was down less than just about 90 pounds, about 88 pounds. And I was dying, and I knew it. And I knew my mind was, everything was, I was just shattered. And it was weird. Everything was weird. Really weird. And so, I was in that kind of shape when I went to, I was in Los Angeles, and I live in Orange County, but I was in Los Angeles, and this is what happened to me. But there's a couple of things happened I want to just mention that happened, and I don't know the order of how they happened. But my sister had taken me in, and I was staying with my sisters, and I left my sisters, one night, and my little niece ran after me down the driveway. And she threw her arms around me and she said, "Uncle Al, are you going to get drunk again tonight?" And it was just like somebody put a hot poker right through my body. Just, oh boy, almost killed me. And then, I was on a job and I came to, I know I was taken to the job. Because I never had learned how to drive a car yet. I was about 34. And I was on the job, and I knew I had murdered my niece. And I had put her body in the closet. And I took the clothes and I put them over her body. And there was blood all over. And I was waiting for the security police to come and arrest me. And I wanted to just shoot me right there. I knew I did it. I married this child. And, I fought all day long waiting for these people. My mind was just going out of my mind, waiting for them to come arrest me. So they didn't come and arrest me, so I knew they didn't find the body. Nobody found the body. And so, when they took me home that night, the fellows took me home that night, and they left me off, and this little girl come running down the driveway. And I almost dropped dead because I knew how I'd killed that child. And everything was as vivid as anything in my life. And that happened. And which of those two happened first, I don't know. And then the other thing I told you, I was wandering around here in Los Angeles. I was up around Spring and Hill Street, or that area. And there was a man passing out tracts on the street corner up there. And I stopped this man, and he started talking to me. And as he talked to me, I told him I was half drunk or whatever I was. And he realized I was drunk, at least partially drunk. And so he started telling me that he was a drunk. He used to be a drunk. And he's passing out these tracts on his streetcar as penance for the things he did as a drunk. And so I started crying there on that streetcar. It was in the daytime, and I was crying. And this man said to me, he read this tract to me. And here's what he read to me. I still have the tract that he read to me. It says, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape." He read that to me, and then he asked me if I would let him pray for me. And I got down on my knees on the street corner. I was crying and crying. And he put his hand on the top of my head and he prayed for me to find a way to stop drinking. He didn't mention Alcoholics Anonymous, but a way to stop drinking. The next little sequence thing that I can remember is the central office of Wilshire Boulevard. I went to the central office of Wilshire Boulevard, and a man named Jack and a lady named Dean were there, and they gave me coffee for whom I don't know how long that was, and they gave me a book, Orange County Meetings. And the next thing I can tell you, I walked into a meeting on 550 South Los Angeles Street on June 21st, 1960. To a meeting of Rock House Namas. There were two men in the room, and I walked into that room, and I slithered into a little tiny place, a little small place, and I slithered into a corner there, and there were overstuffed chairs and things like that, and I just got myself down, and a man came over, and his name was Bob Lee Master, and he put his arm out. He was standing up, and he was a tall fella, and he put his arm down there, and he had a smile on his face like a jackass eating cactus. And he looked down, and he looked down at me, and he said, "My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. And if you have a drinking problem, you're in the right place." And I looked up at him, and I said, "Mister, if there's anything I have, it's a drinking problem." And so, some more time passed, and I know people started coming in, but I don't remember. I only remember this other thing. That, what he told me first, and then this other thing. He told me, "You can leave this meeting and never take another drink of alcohol again as long as you live if you don't want to." And I wanted to believe that with all my heart. I wanted to believe that. I wanted to die sober because I don't know if you ever thought about it, but I believed in the hereafter. I believed in hell. You understand? Now, I thought of this many times when I would come off a drunk. Suppose I had died in it. I see myself going to, you know, to who's ever in charge of the thing. And when he starts to question you, and you're standing there, "Well, you know, he's just going to say, down elevator, you know. And no way to plead your case. No, you can't do anything." So I want, you know, I dreaded that. And so here I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have an automobile. It was 5.5 miles back and forth to the meetings. And I walked those miles back and forth. And I would sit on the curb. And I would be retching and retching, sitting on these curbs. And ask God, "Give me strength to go, get up and go." And I'd walk another block and another block. And I went to that meeting on 550 South Los Angeles Street. And I went down there when it wasn't open. And I climbed through that window. They have old broken windows, and I climbed up through those windows, and I got the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat there all by myself all day long with that book Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew this thing had to, you know, something had to, and I, you know how it is, you try to read and you can't read, you get a sentence in it, you know, and then you have to go over and over. It doesn't matter, I just kept trying, and kept trying, and kept trying, and the ladies had an Al-Anon room just, you know, very close. And in between was the head, you know. And so I would have to throw up so much. I'd drink a little coffee, and then I'd go into the men's room, and I'd try to throw up quietly so the ladies wouldn't disturb the ladies, you know. And I would, and then, you know, I'm, and they go, you know, God bless them Al-Anons, I tell you, they were so wonderful to me, and I had never been married or anything like that. I never was married, I never owned property, I never had learned how to drive a car. I was busy. And there was a man, you know what happens, they start to see you. They start to notice you. They start to take you home from meetings. And then after a while, they know where you live, and they start getting you and taking you to meetings and taking you home from the meetings. And so time was on, and there was a man, you remember Dan Blocker, how big Dan Blocker was. We had a man named Tyree Ford. He was big like Dan Blocker. And he had a cattle ranch, a real cattle ranch, really, with cows and stuff. And he was, a giant of a Texan. And, you know, he looked down at this little bundle of rags, and he gathered me in. And he pulled me up to him, and he looked down, and he said,
you're going to be all right, little buddy. You're going to be all right.
And praise God, I was all right. I was in the hands of Alcoholics Anonymous and these people. And they taught me, and they taught me, and they taught me. And they helped me, and they helped me, and they helped me. And then, you know how time goes on. They started to go here with them and go there with them. I had the first thing off, I had a job in the kitchen washing cups and saucers. We had real cups and saucers then. And so I remember Frank Choke, he said to me, he said, "Now, you work in the kitchen, but," he said, "I don't want you to dry anything." He said, "These things cost a lot of money. And right now, you're a natural agitator, so you just get your hand in there." And so 1 year, you know, a year passed, and I had a birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then time went on, and I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's an experience for an old sailor to, you know, at 35 or so, whatever I was. Wow, that's an awful lot different than going to see the sights, I'll tell you that. But I've been married now. I've been married now for a long time, and my wife isn't here tonight. And Dennis knows I can tell you. You see, I've learned how to argue with my wife. You know, what I try to do with my wife is let her get the last word in as soon as possible. And I love her dearly, I'll tell you. And so time marches on in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I never had children. My wife had 5 children before I ever knew her, and I was able to, thank God so much for this. I had never had a child, but when I married my wife, we had a 9-year-old girl. And I was able to help raise that girl till she got married, and she's got a wonderful life, this girl. And then, as time went by, you know, a granddaughter had a son. And so I am a step-great-grandfather. And this little boy who I said, "This girl shouldn't have this child. She's only 15. She shouldn't have this child. She'll have an abortion." You know, it just don't seem crazy to have this child. And God is probably saying, "You fool, what I have in store for you, are you trying to destroy?" You see, I learned a valuable lesson. Because this boy came into our lives 6 weeks after it was born. And has been in our lives now for these past 11 years. And you see, I helped raise a girl from 9 to marriage and a child from 6 weeks to 11. God has allowed me to help raise a child. And let me even have half boy and half girl. And I'm so grateful to God for these things, to Alcoholics Anonymous, for these most wonderful things that have happened to me. It's been one of the greatest journeys in the world. You get to travel a lot in your time, and I love traveling. Always like new places, so forth and so on. But this journey to Alcoholics Anonymous has been one of the most fabulous experiences I've ever been on. To see people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and see them shaken, God bless them. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, you see a man take a cup of coffee to his wife like he's been a waiter all his life. Huh? Well, I see by the old clock on the wall that it's time for me to get down from up here. I wanted to tell you, I had a sponsor who's dead, Elmer Radwell. And I'll tell you what Elmer did to me one day, and I just got time to tell you and sit down. Elmer was a tall man, a poor man, a very poor man, but a most wonderful man. And this is how he taught me a great thing in Alcoholics Anonymous that has helped me to this day. One day I went down to Elmer's house. I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to complain. And I went down there, and I seen Elmer, and he was sitting there dunking tea bags in tea. And I started on him, and I told him about this one and this problem and this one and that problem and these bosses, all these problems. And he never said a word. He just played cribbage by himself and dunked this tea bag, you know, and drink tea and more. And the more I talk, the more mad I'm getting. And I keep going and going. And finally, I give up. You know, I'm finished. And Elmer says, "Are you through, son?" He was 70-some years old at this time. He said, "Are you through, son?" I said, "Yes, Elmer, I'm through." He said, "Why don't you change it?" And I said, "Elmer, you haven't listened to a damn thing I've said in the last hour. I can't change it." He said, "I'll accept it." And his hands went right up like that. And he had me nailed right to the wall. And that's how it's been. It's a program of growing and great happiness for me. Great joy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I find this the most fascinating, wonderful, happy journey and wonderful thing. Sobriety is just the most wonderful thing. And I want to thank you all for letting me come up here and share with you.